Our speaker this morning is Dr. Cheng Ik Moon. He currently serves as an academic dean of Christ College, Irvine, in Irvine, California, and is also a professor of sociology at the same school. In addition to his duties at the college, he also serves on a number of committees, boards, and agencies. Among them, he is a member of the Urban Ministry Committee of the Pacific Southwest District. He is a coordinator of the Korean Pastoral Colloquy Program. His topic on which he will be speaking this morning is titled Understanding the Metro Mission Horizons, Precondition for Successful Cross-Cultural Ethnic Ministry. He will provide us with some insights on the role that culture plays in a given ethnic group and also as it affects our strategies for the promotion and development of cross-cultural ethnic ministry. The topic on which he speaks is not entirely unknown to us at Concordia Seminary, as we also have on our faculty Dr. Won Young Ji. Won't you welcome with me Dr. Cheng Ik Moon?
Very pleased to be here with you, and I'm sorry that I brought with me from California a sore throat. I don't know whether it's the rainy St. Louis weather, which I had forgotten, or something else, but I hope I can still stay close to the mic so that you could hear me. Are you hearing me okay in the back? I'm sorry about this. Ordinarily, my voice is too loud, and I always get accused for yelling at all the time, but today is going to be different. I would like to also use this opportunity to express my gratitude for being invited back here. This is my alma mater, and certainly good to be back to see old places and also have opportunity to chat with Professor Feuerhahn, who is my classmate and dear friend, and I'm sure there are others whom I also had opportunity to chat already. It's good to see, and also good to see many of our alumni of CCI. And so it's like a homecoming, and it's like all other events in the Lutheran Church in Missouri Synod. Wherever you go, you never get away from each other. We are really a closed tribal society, no doubt. So kindred spirit prevails here, and I come here only not to provide any profound wisdom or anything of that sort, but rather to provide forum within which we can enter into discussion of the cross-cultural and ethnic ministry. I also like to bring the greetings from Christ College Irvine, as well as from Pacific Southwest District, particularly Urban Ministries Committee. As they have learned that I was coming here, they emphasized that I should do so. Today, then, our topic is a very exciting one. It is a timely one. It's timely because the topic speaks of opportunities. An opportunity is always a thing that lasts only for a short time. If you look at it from a macroscopic point of view, opportunities always came but lasted only for a short time. And such a time is this time, the opportune time. As the famous phrase, carpe diem goes, we either seize it or lose it. And that gives a sense of urgency and exigency to act. There is no room for complacency when it comes to these important issues that provide us such a profound opportunities. When we talk about Metro Mission, its horizon, imagine for yourself visually, early dawn when you look at the silhouette of a metropolitan areas, what do you see? Obviously, we would like to say all the tall skyscrapers against the horizon. But if you really take a closer look, what you find is a tremendous variety of people, unlike two or three decades ago. The scenes have changed, and Dr. Mansky yesterday have already keynoted for you all those changing and emerging scenes of the ethnic mix. And therefore, cross-cultural and ethnic ministry simply means there is tremendous opportunity in the horizon for us to seize. The area where I come from, which no doubt is not like maybe any other areas, but in some sense it is also like other areas, and I'm speaking of L.A., we have a section that is called Chinatown. And then as if it's complete, there is a Koreatown. You go there and you think you're literally in Seoul, Korea. Sign, everything, business, language, custom, it's all there. And then there is area called the Little Tokyo. They're not going to miss out on this game. And then there is a little Saigon. East L.A., as you know, is known for their population concentration of Hispanics. West L.A. is heavily black. Of course, the Watts gave a famous name some time ago already. And then if you go down further to the Orange County, you will see a tremendous amount of out-migration from the metropolitan L.A. now taking over some of the peripheral areas traditionally held tightly by white populations. Even in North Hollywood, our district received the plea to begin an Armenian ministry. Whoever heard of that before? And so, as a member of the Southern California, which is now Pacific Southwest District Urban Ministry Committee, we encounter many, many interesting requests. And that, in a way, serves a framework for my thinking. And although many of you come from the area that might be quite different from what I'm used to, but nevertheless, I believe that if California is always weird and strange, it always set the pace anyway. It was the future things to come. And so, you are not so far behind. It's surely coming, your area also. And so, if we thought that California was weird and strange, and we no longer think so, and so likewise, you may encounter very strange things happening in your area, in your community, they will come when those things will be ordinary. And that we have to go about doing what was ordinary business, which will become extraordinary task for our mission horizons. Your context is no doubt quite different. I was trying to imagine myself as I was preparing my presentation, who would be the people I would be addressing this morning. And I could not get a clear picture, because no doubt the people who assemble here come from many different geographical locations with a different context of the ministry. Some of you may be involved in what I would call cross-culturally relevant ministry. Others of you may come in the context of ethnic ministry relevant context. I'd like to clarify those two differences in a moment later. But for now, let me say that also some of you may come from a frontline infantryman position whose feet is wet doing their work one-to-one with ethnic groups or cross-cultural ministry. Others of you, no doubt, have a different form, more of the context of resourcing, referral services, enabling, facilitating role. Both are equally legitimate and equally needed role in our mission horizon today. Let me hasten then to go on to address two issues. One, cross-cultural ministry, and the other, the ethnic ministry. The distinction is basically that the one involves the ministry that cuts across the cultural line, depending upon your context, where you see many people of other cultures in your neighborhood, then there is a necessity for you to minister to them as you minister to your own traditional white congregations. The ethnic ministry, on the other hand, is the context in which there are large pockets of ethnic subgroups with a distinct subcultures that is so pervasive that it will be very difficult for you to penetrate into that subculture. You need other kinds of help. You almost need the help of the native workers who will, together with you, either team up or in a variety of forms, which we will discuss later. Let me then first talk about the cross-cultural ministry, which may be relevant to some of you and others may not, but nevertheless might be helpful in some ways. When we talk about the cross-cultural ministry, what is most needed is sensitivity to the cultures of the people. The sensitivity should include not only understanding of culture, but also how the culture works to for or against your ministry. Culture is a very broad term which we easily toss out and often misunderstood. We say that person is a very highly cultured person. That highly cultured person, we almost imply that is a civilized person, highly educated person. That is not what we mean by culture. What we mean by culture is that totality of way of life. That is established pattern of behavior by which human beings conduct their life in a given society. Of course, that seems very self-evident and does not require much explanations, we say. But we take so much for granted. Ants and bees behave in highly organized fashions, but they are driven by instinct. The human beings, for whatever the reason, may go back as far back to original sin. We are highly disarrayed, disorganized people. Left it up to ourselves, we will surely create chaos. We are self-centered creatures. And therefore, we need culture, patterned behavior, to govern our life together. I don't mean individual life, but our life together. And so, it is our design for whole life, in some sense of the word, a blueprint for daily behavior, when it comes down to in a narrow sense of the word. And we are enculturated to this pattern of life, a design for behavior. From early on up, they are almost subconscious. There is something that you do that you don't even think about. As I often encountered in America, as I'm trying to learn even the language, which is such an example of one of the cultural artifacts, I try to decide what is the right preposition for which noun. Do we say in the morning? Why not at morning? Why not on the morning? In the morning? Somehow, you have to choose one. Now, for you, it is very subconscious. You automatically figure out what is right. If I say at morning, then you say it doesn't sound right. But why is it in the afternoon? Or not at afternoon? But noon, not in noon, but at noon. At 5 o'clock, not in 5 p.m., on 5 p.m., but on time. But at times, and so, you know, I get all confused and say, now, which proposition is the right one for one single item revolving around time? Concept of time itself is so different. In the Western context of time, Eastern context of time, just the illustration is what all I'm doing here. I mean, we can really go into the depth, but Enculturation is automatic, is the whole point. And because of that, these are not conscious elements often. It governs our behavior illogically. Logic is not the reason for our behavior. That's the way we have always done it. Of course, churches behave that way too, by the way, don't we? That's always the way we have done it. Now, enculturation then, which is necessary element for design and the pattern of life, nevertheless is a form of indoctrination. Whether we like it or not, we are all indoctrinated. It's not a dirty word. It's just simply the way it is. One learns the standard behavior. One makes their decisions in the way he thinks is right. And that, in turn, makes us blind to other possibilities. So often, we are enslaved, in one sense of the word, to the way of doing things that was handed down to us by our ancestors, because that is the way it worked. That was fine in a traditional society when the things did not change very much. After all, culture isn't not something that somebody all of a sudden concocted. It is simply a human response to the environment in which one has to cope and survive. And whatever had the highest survival value, that persisted as culture. In the traditional society, culture persisted for hundreds, or if not thousands of years, providing a way of life that is best suited for the group of people. But the scenes have changed. Our human society and its uniqueness is that we do not begin every generation new, but everything is cumulative, additive. Our knowledge multiply in geometric ratio rather than simply arithmetic ratio. Changes came about rather rapidly because of that in recent years. All of us are fully aware of the knowledge explosion, that if you had done your PhD 5 years ago, today, I was told that you will miss half of the questions. So obviously you flunk 5 years later. In that kind of society, the culture which blinds us can be detriment. The reason for the culture was adaptive value, but that culture itself today incapacitate our adaptive dimension. And so we have to think not only my own possibilities that is out of kilter, but also we consider others' way of life strange, sometimes boorish, other times downright savage. It's difficult for us to be open-minded, especially when another unit of population, another cultural group does things in a certain way that we are not used to. Obviously, for many of us, talking about eating a dog meat is very repulsive. Have you ever tasted one? It tastes good. But if you go to China, it is sometimes a common diet. It comes in such a sharp contrast, as expressed in the movie a long time ago called The Mundo Cani, where there was an elderly lady in a fur coat going to walking a French poodle. Lovely dog. The dog dies, and she gives elaborate funeral to a French poodle. Enormous amount of money is spent for that funeral. And the next scene is dog cage in China restaurant. A man comes in, about a party of about a dozen people. They come for a dinner, and they point to a dog. And next time you know it, the dog is in a boiling pot. Such a contrast and shock. That's the world of culture. Some eat with a hand, and we think it's insanitary. Of course, others do such a strange thing, like using chopsticks, poking at things. But we are proud of the fact that we can even catch flies with a chopstick as it flies by. Cockroaches are obviously disgusting, but we don't mind the fried ants as a delicacy served at the highest class restaurants in America. For some African tribe people, milk is described as nauseating, disgusting animal secretion. And we glorify it and we promote it. And where would American farm product be if we didn't have that one? Now, when we realize that culture is basically an adaptive system, then I think it can help us, first of all, to be empathetic to other people. They have reasons why they have done it that way. Their honest attempt to cope with the human dilemmas gave way of solving their needs through that kind of patterned behavior. And if so, all these strange customs cease to be ridiculous and become understandable. We are less inclined to be discouraged when we cannot change them, when we do not receive cooperation, when we downright have rejection. When we, with a good intent, propose a good way, and when we receive rejection, we are not going to be discouraged, because we know that that is their adaptive mechanism to their situation in life. If so, we apply that to a gospel of Jesus Christ. What adaptive role does the gospel of Jesus Christ play in socioeconomic and politically relevant apostolic action? I think that is a very important question we must not dismiss. If the cultures of the world came into being because there is need for this adaptation, then certainly the gospel of Jesus Christ, which is a culture, all of its own. What role does this culture play in individual human beings? And we can put the flesh and blood to this individual human being in your neighborhood. In their context of socio-economic and of political context, how is the gospel of Jesus Christ relevant? And you, who are the carrier of that gospel, what action of yours is apostolically relevant action? I think searching that question could give us some clue as to what are the things we ought to do. Meeting the needs of the people, such as adaptive needs, can be applied to the cross-cultural ministry because, by definition, these people are from another culture. Their immediate need in your neighborhood is obviously socio-economic, and political. They are worried about their jobs. They are displaced people, uprooted from their homeland, coming to new place. That should not be strange to us, by the way. We describe Christianity as a sojourners in this world. Yes, we can empathize with them. If the world is against us, and we often feel that, and particularly this day and age, if so, you can also empathize with the feeling of these people who are sojourners in this land. They're strangers. They do not have all the connections that you and I have. I was a stranger, but having lived here more than 30 years now, I feel I have quite a bit of connection now. I feel like I'm a member of this tribe called the Missouri Synod, and that I feel very comfortable here. But that was not so the day I arrived in San Francisco with one suitcase. I recall with a fond memory how I felt. Everything was new, totally lost. Now, jobs are one of the key needs of the people, as I saw, most of cross-cultural people. And as I saw the successful cross-cultural ministry, what one thing in common they have, that they are facilitating people. One of the reasons why many of the ethnic people go to the church is where they can make the connections. They don't know how to connect. But when they go to church, there are all kinds of people with all kinds of the jobs that they do, and they have a little information for, in my place, the two people have left, and there's a job opening. Okay, I better go there right away. I know my boss is looking for a job. Or I lost a job. Do you know anybody who is looking for a worker? That happens always right after church service, during the social hour. Social hour is usually very long. They even have a meals together. It's how natural, of course, for church to have the meals together. It's almost like an ancient love feast. And then during that time, they do a tremendous amount of business. Now, that is certainly sounds like an unreligious event. But when you look at the total context of individual need, and we talk about ministry to the whole person, then this should not be strange. We, who have connections, you know, society, political connections, economic connections, social welfare agencies, can offer a tremendous amount of service to these people. And as a grateful people, they would like to know what it is that you do, you believe that you are so helpful to me. And that becomes a witness, and through that, you couldn't keep them away from church because they want to know what it is. Poverty is often also a very common thing we see among the ethnic group people. With that comes also welfare questions. USA has a wonderful welfare systems, social work agencies, all those provisions. It's not so much we don't have them. Problem is, delivery system is something that does not reach people who need. Very often you hear this comment, how so much of the money that we earmark for a variety of the program really goes down to the bureaucracy. By the time it sifts down to the people at the in the street, it becomes very dismal. Many people in the street really don't know where to go. And so that delivery system is a problem. It's not so much we don't have resources. We have a tremendous amount of resources in America. So resourcing is an important role, again, we can play in a cross-cultural ministry. Healthcare, obviously, is another area that these people are in need. Sickness is emergency. And when you deal with the people in emergency, whatever you do is appreciated hundredfold. Doing something for somebody who doesn't need any help will be very little appreciated. But when somebody is in a great need, that's the time to offer your help. Alienation, yes, that is part of the situation. Do you realize that many of these people who immigrate here hold what they call green card? The green card is a permanent residency card without which they feel very insecure. And they are called aliens. the alien registrations. And that the word itself is very descriptive of kind of thing that they may experience. And as a result, sense of alienation, sense of not belonging to, it takes time. It does not come automatically. It's none of our fault. We don't take the blame for it in the sense that we made them feel uncomfortable. We did not unwelcome them. But it is within their own psyche. They are strangers who came to this land. By virtue of their newness, they are strangers. Alienation is self-ascribed alienation, which is the reason the harder it is for us to penetrate that barrier. It's almost like, in some sense, and a good analogy would be a Jewish ghetto. Some ghettos, we build walls around them because we keep them out. But some ghettos are built by the in-group, like a Jewish group often built their own walls and would not let others in. Many of the ghettos today in ethnic and the cross-cultural barrios are like that too. And so our effort has to be indeed a very heroic in nature to penetrate those cross-cultural barriers. And at the same time, their sense of loneliness, uprootedness, insecurity, they long for friendship. They want to be not a second-class citizen. They want to be somebody. And so all these needs are there. And besides, there are some life significant moments, such as weddings. Many of them don't know where to go get married. We are the perfectly legitimate source of providing that need with the gospel that could come as a witness. People die, funerals, another emergency moment. And of course, many people have certain the ecclesiastical stance by which they find compelled to refuse funerals, those who are not members. So you have to think about that a little bit, you know. What does it all mean? It's not for me to here to prescribe anything, but it seems to me there are perfect moments when people are faced with such ultimate issues as the birth, wedding, and death, that we should be relevant, and we have what it takes to meet their need. And so that takes me to the next point, that is, these people are no different than you and me, who, well, if we can get away from the busy hustle and bustle of the day, there are moments when we think about the ultimate things, the universal quest for meaning, and don't think that they don't have it. In fact, they have that more often because they already have lost, in some sense of the word, the meaning of life as they were detached from their homeland. The quest for origin. Where do I come from? That's a universal question in every culture. Purpose of life. What am I for today? And then the question of destiny. Where am I going? And if we can successfully capitalize on these three universal quests for meaning, I think we can also figure out some ways to devise a relevant apostolic action. Now, with that I will simply leave it up to your imagination to figure out how you might be able to do the cross-cultural ministry, and we might want to discuss that a little bit at the end of our session. But let me move on to the ethnic ministry. Ethnic ministry has its own context. There are several preconditions, it seems to me. First is the changing neighborhood. Often there are flights of whites, which for some time is now being described as a suburban captivities. In most of the cities today, it seems to me, there are pockets of areas where whites are running away. some old-time hard, tough people is hanging in there. But you can just see the handwriting on the wall. It's just a matter of time. Some move away, but still coming back. They are memory's sake, tradition's sake, nostalgia, whatever it is. It's still holding people. But again, it's a matter of time. Now, when you see things like that, what are we going to do? Do we just see it fizz out and die out? Or do we take some proactive measure rather than having it die a disgraceful, slow death? When we have such an old and dying church, I think it calls for concerted effort in the part of individual pastor of their congregation, members, circuit, the district, or even synod at large. We have to do something to turn the tide around. I think this is a good context for the ethnic ministry. Obviously, the place is not really empty. It's just the population shift has occurred. It's not so much that people are not there. In fact, people are more crowded in that area than ever before. Therefore, usually, that context brings concentration of another ethnic group. Then we have to think about what we can do to minister to this people, and that goes beyond what any one pastor who was involved in a traditional ministry, such as to the kind of ministry we have always known, a stable ministry that is whose pews filled with faithful members of the congregation in three generations. We have to think about what we can do to find a native minister or a church worker who could relate with these people. I think it's too much to ask for a white pastor who had not been educated in that culture, nor have spent some time with the people, nor have received to meet a culture shock of this kind, to expect them to be effective ministers in that context, especially when few people still hanging in there have a set way and no way are they going to change. Pastor is put in such a dilemma position. That person needs a team ministry or another form of ministry we will look at in a moment. And that, as a synod, we have to put our heads together. And how are we going to raise more of ethnic ministers? This thing came to me in a very painful way. I was happily doing my thing in rural, maybe it's not so rural, in Midwest, Fort Wayne, Indiana. I was teaching at the Concordia Senior College in Ivory Tower. Great. Until I received a call to Christ College in Irvine. That's 15 years ago. When I first went out there, I saw a huge number of Korean population. I didn't know that they were all there. They were really best kept secret as far as I was concerned. I don't know why in the world I didn't know that. By the way, I didn't even know that that area had a perpetual summer and spring weather. That was best kept secret too. And, you know, it was Christmas time and people were going around with their short sleeves. I think it's conspiracy. They don't want us to be out there and crowd their streets. You know, that's why they don't tell us about that. But I didn't know the place like that existed. And there, all these ethnic groups flock in because weather is so kind, I think. That's the reason. And also, it is the Pacific Rim. Get off the boat, there you are, right there, right? Sure. The Ellis Island was the last century. Many European immigrants obviously came to the East Coast. Now the 21st century is going to be undoubtedly the L.A., not the Ellis Island. Pacific Rim is where all the actions are now. And so as you look at that area, I was amazed. There was already over 100 Korean churches. And I said, wow. I asked, how many Lutheran churches? Zero. Why? Why don't we have any Korean churches, Lutheran churches here in West Coast? We have Lutheran churches there. And so I remember knocking at the door at the district office. We got to do something about this situation. There's more than 100 Korean churches, but not one Lutheran churches. Of course, church does not emerge all of a sudden. It has to be planned, strategized, resources found. It takes time. You know how it moves. A church moves very slowly, you know. So I remember it took three years before we finally appropriated fund for one Korean ministry. And then we had to look around to find a person to staff that position. And where do we find one? If we go to Korea and bring somebody, that person needs help. Rather than, you know, coming to a strange land, than being helpful. Remember I said the ministers in ethnic ministry have to be relevant in meeting the needs of the people who are here. He has to be a resourcing person. He has to have connections. We cannot suddenly transplant somebody from some foreign countries and hope that he will do the job. Somebody who has to be bicultural in many ways. Fortunately, we found a person who was, at the time, doing graduate study at the seminary, who was graduate of seminary in Korea, who was a Lutheran, and so we asked him to come to do this. And that's how one church began in L.A. area. But what do we do next? What do we do next? And so I remember how we thought about a variety of ways where we can raise workers. That led to another decision, which took about another 3-4 years to establish, and that was called Korean Pastors Pastoral Colloquy Program, which was the idea that there are some pastors out there already. Particularly in the Korean context, there are many, many seminary-trained pastors whose church background was like Presbyterians, Methodists, Roman Catholics, and some Baptists. If so, one of the things that they did not have is facility. And so they are coming to the Lutheran churches and ask whether they could meet there. And we thought about that and said, hey, they're coming to us and asking us whether we would allow them to meet in our facilities. Why not ask them to join us? But then, they are Presbyterians. Why not educate them? Colloquize them. All right, fine. What do we need to colloquize them? At the time, we had no other way but to send them to seminary for 2 years. Now, when you take the pastor away from that flock and plant it in St. Louis or Fort Wayne, then what we find is that people, they're sheep stealers. Other pastors come and steal the sheep away. And so the congregation is lost. And 2 years later, what happened to the pastor? So we said, no, we cannot do that. What do we do then? Could seminary have an extension out there? But with a one or two people, it's not cost effective. So one of the things then we did was, all right, then why don't we have locally sponsored ministry, which is specifically designed to Lutheranize, quote-unquote, these pastors. Certainly they may not be, you know, fully enculturated to the Missouri Synod as we have known in the past, but for the sake of emergency and for the time being, until we have large enough mass of workers, let us compromise and have a system, certainly not the most ideal, but at least workable, and devise steps by which they can locally become colloquialized. It involved, for instance, initially taking two courses. One was the key doctrine of the Lutheran Church, how they are so different from any other church, be it Presbyterian or the Methodist and so on. We call that Dogmatics 1. And then, when they know the key differences as to what we are, Lutherans are, and why we are what we are. And then with that, also another course that came with that was the Book of Romans. We felt that the Lutheran theology is very much epitomized in Romans. So we will study Book of Romans together. And that's usually about 6 months study, those two items. And after 6 months, then we will ask them, now you know what Lutheran Church stands for. Where are you theologically? Do you resonate with the Lutheran theology, or do you feel this is unacceptable? If they say it's unacceptable, we say bye-bye. If they say I like it, then we say, let us continue. And so they enter into the second phase. The second phase contains four more areas of study. Dogmatics 2, which studies entire doctrines, of all the doctrines of Lutheran Church. Lutheran Confession, with a historical theology, the Book of Concord is used. And then we also use practical theology and ethnically relevant ministry. And they are also to establish church, congregation, and start training their people. And so they all have their own congregations under supervision of American pastor, the head pastor they matched. It's like a sort of glorified vicarage, if you want to call it that. And so there were four different things that they do for another year and a half. So in 2 years' time, then, while they are working as well as learning, this particular program would be completed. In so doing, we have raised five more pastors in our area. In addition, we had at the Christ College two students who came from Korea, whom we identified as a good candidate. We said, how about going into the ministry, and they took pre-sem programs, went to seminaries, and just this past year returned. So we have two more. So altogether in Southern California District, when we talk about Korean ministry alone, we have eight Korean ministries begun. Very small beginning. But the point that I'm trying to make is that there are some congregations and some context of the white their flight to the suburb, that calls for ethnic ministry. Now, this ethnic ministry takes many different forms, by the way. There's not one model. So this is the point that I would like to then interject some of the models of ethnic ministry. The first model may be considered a parent-child model. Let me illustrate that with a little drawing. Maybe a joint worship service, or some separate devotions, prayer groups. So the host congregation in this case actually begin a new group, that within a group with a common membership, with a many common activities, but provide some unique experiences. That would be one form of ethnic ministry. This can be done when the congregation is sufficient in its strength to carry on that ministry. If the congregation is too weak, this model may not be possible. The second model is a sub-ministry, where in that case, the host congregational role is to sponsor a ministry. Another group of people who are ethnically orientated, you sponsor their group meetings, even sponsor financially if possible, but sponsor does not necessarily mean financial alone, facilitating it. And they will have their own leader, their own worker, their own even clergy sometimes somebody is around, or vicars often can function in that capacity. Here you have, at best, a kind of affiliated membership, not a common membership, maybe affiliated. But activities are separate. This kind of thing is successful if the group feels very comfortable being separate, because they cannot adapt to a new culture or the American culture, and give them sense of own ownership, and yet being well supported by the host congregation. The third model, however, is when host congregation and separate congregation has a tie, where you have joint activities, but actually two autonomous separate entities. They are using your facility, so that the role of the host congregation is facilitating the other ministry. Now, this is one of the most common form of ministry that I see happening today in our ethnic ministry. It has also a lot of pain involved with it, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And then another model would be when we have a daughter congregation, when one, the host, gives birth to a daughter congregation, either financially or leadership-wise, resourcing, whatever way, to give them an independent congregation at the independent location. This kind of thing can be done only if your congregation is quite well-to-do with your resources, strong enough that you can give a birth to and plant the church. Suppose you are a huge church of, let's say, 1,000, and then you know there is one pocket in someplace over there 2 miles away, there's an ethnic group, and you give birth of a new congregation over there. That would be daughter congregation. Yet another model is the opposite of this, where a congregation is too weak really to do anything, to do any of these things that we're talking about. In that case, then they give up. And they will simply say, let's put our resources together and join. And so a host is here, and another ministry, maybe even three of them, come together. They sort of resolve ownership. They recombine, almost conglomerate model, a corporation model. They may have a principle by which they operate, joint ownership, joint sponsorship of maintenance, and that sometimes they may do things together, other times they may do differently. They may even independent bylaws, administrative structure may be different, but they live together as a conglomerate unit. And that kind of thing, I think, requires much thinking. And I wish that our church will really push that model more. Today, many of the churches are literally at that point. They are too weak to do anything. And yet, they are too proud or too stubborn not to give up. And there's a lot of hard feelings and conflict. Some of them are downright afraid, even when this situation occurs. When one becomes larger, the ethnics become larger and larger, these people are threatened. They're afraid that they may get swallowed up. And so harsh feelings occur. And we already had one such occasion in Southern California. And there were, case in point, was around, there were about a dozen people only left. They became increasingly more defensive. They said, well, Korean congregation is using more facility than we do. So that if their meeting goes beyond the time that they said they would, they were very upset. Additional meetings scheduled, not right. Children playing in the playgrounds and bringing sand into the thing was aggravating to no end. And so all kinds of conflict arose. Misunderstanding came. And finally, they decided, they asked Korean congregation to leave. They didn't want that hassle anymore. And then shortly thereafter, then they also wanted to sell the whole congregation and then moved away. But the sad thing about that was most people who were there were not the residents in that area. They all drove in from some other place. They were old members, the vestige of the old membership. Drove in. They could have easily gone to the churches of their own neighborhood. And this church really should have been either like this one or simply given to the district so the district may do the ministry there because that was a very viable, good location. But nevertheless, that church was put on sale and ironically, Korean Presbyterian Church bought it and now Lutheran ministry is lost. It's that kind of situation. It's just a sad commentary on our church now putting our heads together and acting in concert, looking for the greater goal and what are we going to do rather than individuals simply responding to the emergencies. So there are many of these situations that we can discuss. Successful precondition, then, is understanding the cultural dynamics, and I would like to emphasize this very quickly here before I give you the handout that I will look at it very briefly. That anthropologists talked about the cultural dynamic as having process called acculturation, which leads to assimilation, which leads to amalgamation. Those are three stages. This is a very time-tested concept, the theory of cultural dynamics. Now, many people disputed this theory in the recent years, particularly when they said, the acculturation, assimilation, amalgamation imply a melting pot. And American case studies show that America is not a melting pot, but it is rather a salad bowl, that we are not forced to melt to become one, but rather each identity is allowed to remain separate. And so that the world is now a cultural pluralism, password is cultural diversity, and therefore this whole process of acculturation, assimilation, amalgamation is incorrect. However, I think that is a very premature conclusion who do not fully take into consideration of the totality of the theory itself. Because, you see, we are not talking about the whole process happening in one generation. It's not like my coming from another culture, come to America 35 years ago, and faced with a sudden culture shock, bang, like that, and, struggling to cope with this new culture. And then, 30 years later, assimilating. And that means I am similar to, my behavior is similar to yours, so that I have by now assimilated. And in fact, I will promote what you do, and therefore I am similar to you in that sense of the word. And that's the assimilation stage, and that does occur indeed, in some sense of the word. And amalgamation is, of course, when I'm so mixed up with you, so that I am very, very comfortable being with any of you, and I think like you, and I eat like you, and I even train other people like you do. Then it's supposed to be amalgamation. Now, first step for my amalgamation was when I married an American bride, I suppose. So it's got mixed up. But still, full amalgamation did not occur. It only took my children to amalgamate. Now, my kids are really amalgamated to American culture. And when the Olympic time came, and I was sitting there cheering for Korean teams, and my kids were saying, yay, when American team win, you know? And I said, hey, you guys, traitors. Suddenly I realized, hey, they're American. They're amalgamated. I am still Korean, assimilated. But amalgamation does occur. But we have to give time. So neither concept is wrong. Salad bowl concept is not wrong either, however, in its own way. It has to be understood, and it's useful. Furthermore, what this has implications in the new theology is that our mindset in American culture, meanwhile, have changed. That there is no more a dominant culture. Everything is fluid. It's a new creation. Evolving culture. That one of the dominant cultures we have now is that we no longer have a traditional culture, but the emerging culture in which we agree to disagree. We agree to allow cultural diversity rather than enforce uniformity. That is one of our cultures. That's emerging culture. And that too is a culture, by the way, that we agree to disagree. And we allow the diversity to exist. Though by cultural dynamics, they may amalgamate sooner or later, but nevertheless, meantime, there is no pressure put on them to assimilate, nor to amalgamate. Which means then, every group is allowed to be what they are. So that ethnic ministry is something that take into consideration that there is no more dominant ministerial culture, no more pattern of a ministry that is fit for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, no more Germanic tradition. Certainly today when other ethnic groups coming in, we are under greater pressure. Before, maybe only English-speaking people wrestled with the German services, which gave in nevertheless, but yet how much of German tradition persevered. But now, pressure is on, particularly when you enter into the ethnic ministry. And that's not all bad. As Horace Kamen once said, the great orchestra is not because all play the same instruments, but all play to produce harmony. I think that's a new emerging culture. It has its own reason for existence. With that kind of background then, if you look at the handout that I gave you, it gives some hands-on how to begin ethnic ministry. This too was by trial and error. Initially we went to the pastor and said, we want to do this. Pastor said, yeah, that sounds good, let's do it. And then we got into all kinds of troubles. And pain was so big, we could not reconcile. We break up and we moved. And finally we say, we better get smarter. And so we decided to establish what we call preconditions for successful ethnic ministry, the shared ministry. And so that's what I have tried to outline here for you. And because our time is running out rapidly here, it seems like I don't have really time to go through, but we found that this model to be very successful. Number one is the clear prior understanding, where we have to take into consideration that shared ministry is not a real estate transaction. There must be a theological foundation. You have to discuss, enter into the dialogue in that dimension first. And then you have to have a written agreement. I put attached the models of a written agreement behind. So if you are interested in doing it, do it. This is the minimum. This is only a minimum. Do more elaborate. You can never write down enough, because between the culture, there's a lot of misunderstandings. People think they understand each other, They don't. So please be as specific as possible. And then second thing is ongoing communication. Even with a good preconditions, pre-understanding, we found the communication failure brought about a lot of disasters. So therefore, ongoing communication is second essential ingredient of the successful shared ministry. And the third one is cooperative ministry, that two groups really have to cooperate. There's no way I can underscore emphatically enough on this, and I wish we had more time to discuss each of this area based on our experiences. But anyway, quickly, is there some questions anyone have? Yes, please. Yes, that model requires extraordinary effort by the pastor. Pastors who are bicultural often, you know, like a missionary coming back from other countries. Like somebody was in Japan, fluent in Japanese, fluent in Korean or Vietnamese and so on. And they can do both kinds of things. And it's almost like, in some ways it's like in the early days in Lutheran Church, I understand there was a German service and the English service. And when there were only a dozen people left, and people say, is it really worth for us to carry on the German service? And so they are going to vote. And at the Congregational Voters meeting, all of a sudden, there were 150 people showed up and say, yay, we still continue German service, right? And so that kind of situation, ethnic values that force people to continue that. And so it's an excellent model. I think that's very good. However, another model is when two of them finally, as they live side by side, have some joint effort, for instance, happen to be Sunday school, Bible classes. Why? Because, you see, children, remember that, acculturation, assimilation, the process. They're off-the-boat people, as we call off-the-boat people, need their own identity, separate service, language barriers, and all these things. But their children are now bilingual, or not even bilingual. Now their own mother tongue is uncomfortable. They can't even relate. Pastors' preaching is boring. They're bored to death, and they don't want to be there anymore. So parents really have to send them to the American Bible classes, Sunday schools, so that if two services happen side by side, American service, knowing the time when there's the American Bible class Sunday school, this church service will meet, and the children will go here, and the adults will go here. And then their children automatically become the feeder to the next generation of that church membership. That church member, you achieve that concept automatically by children, the second generation moving in, automatically becoming a member of that church. While the off-the-boat people, and by the way, off-the-boat people are not just something that cease at this moment. They keep coming, you know. They continually come. Therefore, that ministry is a legitimate ministry ongoing way anyway. So that, I think, we like to promote that model. No, in some areas, you have no luxury of trying Model 1. You are not equipped to do the Model 1. Yes. Oh, yes. Many of the liturgical forms, which are very dear to us and aesthetically very pleasing, doesn't mean anything to some of the people, particularly when their cultural background is very strongly reformed, like in Korea, even the people who are familiar with the Christian church. For them, there's no reason for us to insist that we have the kind of liturgy we have. One thing that we, however, found was very useful is confession and absolution. That's very liturgically unique to Lutheran Church. Now, others, some people want to come to us and say, boy, this is like a Catholic, they say. And so, in some ways, that's to our detriment, and they move away. But other times, if we have a chance to explain and say, don't ask Catholic or Protestant, but rather ask, do you need confession and absolution? Many of them says, yes, I need. And say, hey, this is really what I need. So we have about 75% favorable response, 25% negative. So we'd rather take 75% positive rather than a negative of 25%. So most of our Korean congregations have confession and absolution built into their service. But other parts of the service, they vary, very different. But the elements, the essential element, the word and the sacrament, whatever form it takes is still there. We will not do away with that. So we have to distinguish between the form and the substance.
Yes.
How do you work with welfare culture? How do you work with welfare culture?
Welfare culture? Yes. It so happened that many of the Asian cultures are not necessarily what you call the welfare cultures. But although there are people who are in need of welfare, but you find that it's easier to work with them because they have high aspirations. Usually first generation people work together. It's not much like a family business. They open a restaurant in the street corner. Mother, daughter, father, grandpa, grandma, they all work together. There's no overhead cost. And then you'll find that in 3 years' time they make lots of money and move out to the suburbs. They have their own business. That's a typical pattern. So the thing that church can do is often to encourage, make a connection, resourcing, and giving initially our welfare agencies where to get the social security benefits. You know, we have what we call social security supplemental income if you don't have an income. A lot of people don't know that. We have to make sure that they get that benefit, which will give them survival anyway. And thereafter, after you survive, then you can begin to build up your the economic status. You know, that's a very difficult question, and frankly speaking, I do not have answers for that one. And when we talk about third, fourth generation cultures, you know, we do have that phenomenon in America, and that's much greater and a pervasive question than simply a missiological question. And I wish we had time to discuss that. But that in area, certainly, I have great interest in this as a sociology person. And I have my own opinions, but of course, they are my personal opinions, and many of my colleagues do not buy that idea. Sorry that we don't have much more time, so maybe I'll stop here.